This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something completely different because often we talk about diet, we talk about supplements, we talk about exercise, we talk about innovations in the field of natural medicine. Today we're going to take a little bit of a departure, and I think you'll find it quite fascinating. We're going to talk to Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a medical doctor. She is an advocate for what she terms ideal medical care. And from her standpoint, as previously a medical student and as a physician in training, our medical training for doctors is woefully inadequate, oppressive, leads to lots of doctor dissatisfaction, and even physician suicide. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But also it's to the detriment of you, the patients, who experience all this distress on the receiving end. So without further ado, here's Dr. Pamela Weibel. Welcome to Intelligent Medicine.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, give us a little bit about your own background. Of course, you're a medical doctor, conventionally trained. So how did you get into this this type of advocacy? Describe your experience as a med student and then as a physician in training.
Well, just to give people a little bit of background, both my parents are physicians, so as a child I went to work with them and I really saw medicine in its heyday. My dad was a medical examiner, a pathologist, and my mom is a psychiatrist, so in retrospect, obviously physician suicide is a topic that would be very normal for me to deal with, given the fact that I hung out with patients in the morgue with my father as a child and at the state hospital with my mom, who's a psychiatrist.
So, and you're up close and personal with the experience of being a family member in a family of physicians, and sometimes that's not a pretty picture for youngsters growing up with high-powered professionals who are, you know, super engaged professionally and maybe have a little less personal time.
Yeah, they definitely did not have a lot of personal time. To give you an idea of how little we spent kind of with our family, they were just workaholics. Our first family picture, we have me and my brother and my two parents, happened when I was 45 years old. I do not remember, and
wow.
None of us have a picture of all four of us together. Wow. Until recently.
So they had to retire for you to get the family photo down, right?
Yeah, finally on kind of a little reunion.
Wow.
We got that at a restaurant a few years ago before my father died. So, at least I've got one. And I think that this would have been a very traumatic childhood for anyone who was not destined to become a doctor. My brother went into business. I don't think that he understood and it was appreciative of the fact that our parents were not around and did not stay together and all of that. But for me, as a physician kind of blossoming as a little youngster, my dad was introducing me as a doctor in training when I was like 4, 5, 6 years old to his,
right.
You know, he also worked at a methadone clinic, so he's introducing me to his patients there. And back before breathalyzers, by the way, physicians had to be present in the police stations to interview drunk drivers. And so we had our own room at the police station, and we got to interview drunk drivers all night. And I just thought all this stuff was super cool. I loved it, you know. It would have been terrifying for any other child. He probably would have rather been home opening presents with and giving cookies to Santa or something like that. You know what I mean?
Indeed.
So how I got involved in this physician suicide topic is that I realized after I was at a funeral for a local physician who had just shot himself in the head in the middle of a public park. The guy had several kids. He was a top-rated pediatrician in town, and he was our third suicide in 18 months in our relatively small town. And I'm sitting at his memorial service, and I'm counting on my hands the number of suspicious deaths that I knew about among doctors who have died quite young, including both men I dated in med school, and turns out they're all suicides.
Wow.
you know, and I had to like 10 that I counted on my hands just in a short period of time sitting there at his memorial service. So I really feel like this is an investigation that has not happened yet. We have not taken this seriously. I felt like I fell into this this topic, this kind of secret, you know, medical secret, right? This dirty little secret in the medical industry that nobody wants to talk about, and it is absolutely fascinating.
Well,
and
just
tragic.
Just parenthetically, I recently lost a very cherished colleague to suicide, and he was in his 50s, you know, at the peak of his career. And I remember one of the residents that I trained with in medical school, really one of the top trainees. You know, he was a super student. In fact, he was able to get a very privileged residency in dermatology, which is hard to get. He was, you know, outstanding. He started working with one of the top dermatologists in New York City, very famous dermatologist who had a big celebrity clientele. And then I learned that he had committed suicide. And so the circumstances were such that he had been involved in some kind of cosmetic procedure with patients who were coming to the dermatologist, some kind of filler material that they were using. And it turned out the filler material was bad. And it wasn't his fault. You know, he didn't make a mistake, but the filler material was bad. And there was a lawsuit. And under pressure of the lawsuit, this guy who was so used to perfection and being, you know, alpha or omega, you know, phi beta kappa, top of his class, he folded. And it caused him such enormous personal distress that even with a family and kids, two young kids, he killed himself. So is that not is that a more common experience these days? And what, for what reason do doctors seem to be more liable to experience that?
I think it's very common, and we've known that physicians are at a high risk of suicide since 1858 in England, I think was the first time it was reported in literature, and it's 158 years later, and we really haven't made a lot of progress. I mean, it's kind of hard to answer your question since we're not tracking the data. You know, I can't tell you, is it getting worse, better? It does seem really extreme to me, the number of cases that I hear about. I've collected, like, I think 280 just from people calling me and telling me about these partners that they've lost. But I can say, just in my informal analysis of my 280 cases, that for every woman we lose in medical school or as a physician to suicide, we're losing 7 men. So though the profession is skewed towards a higher percentage of men as practicing physicians, it's still extremely higher, the number of men that we're losing, than women. And the methods seem to vary, you know, geographically. Of course, they're more jumping in New York City because they don't have access to guns. They're more gunshot wounds, you know, in Oregon where I live, because you can easily get firearms. And overdoses among anesthesiologists are popular. And it seems that male anesthesiologists are particularly at risk. As far as I think, it seems they're one of the higher risk specialties. So. So, yeah, I think to answer your question the best that I can with a lack of data, it seems to me that things are getting worse because the pressures in medicine are getting worse, the high volume, the high overhead, the high debt load of these medical students, that's all getting worse, right? The public is more adversarial with their physician relationships than, say, they used to be in the 1950s or 60s when people just were really compliant and agreeable and had more maybe respect for physicians, right?
So I think there's a lot of pressure. I heard it said that we lose the equivalent of 2 medical school classes of physicians every year. And if you think of how much it costs, how much you know, society has to support the education of doctors, you know, it's a big enterprise. Much of it's subsidized by, you know, even taxpayer money. These doctors who are gifted, experienced, smart, and then they're lost. They're lost to society because of suicide.
Right, and I think even that statistic minimizes it, the 2 medical school classes, because 400 physicians, I think the average medical school class has about 125 students, and researchers who are involved in this topic believe that the 400 number is an underestimate.
Okay.
So if you look at that as an underestimate, given the number of, you know, death certificates that are miscoded as accidents when they're really intentional, that sort of thing, then, you know, 125 per class, you know, easily we're losing an entire medical school mm-hmm. per year to suicide. And how, and that's not even counting the medical students, which could be between 75 and 150 a year, something like that. We just don't know because they're not, again, not being tracked. The LCME, you know, some of these organizations that accredit medical schools should certainly be tracking not just board scores and pass rates, but how many people we're losing to suicide, which is just unbelievable. In fact, literally right before I get on this interview with you, I was on the phone with a medical student who just had this to say. It was an email he sent, and then I followed up with a phone call, but it goes, "Hello, Dr. Weibel, thank you for all that you do for medical students. We just lost a classmate at my med school to suicide. Several class of 2016 students did not attend their own MD graduation out of protest. Only 60% of the students matched to a residency program, and almost a third of the class of 2016 never finished their MD program. Our school ignores the students. Our classmate's suicide was preventable. We are all depressed. I thought I was going nuts. I went to a psychiatrist who said I was fine. He told me the school is extremely dysfunctional. I hate this place."
Okay. Well, you know, I have to say,
you know, I mean, these schools should not be accredited.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I have to say, some of it is that there's something inherent about medical education that is a little bit like stuffing a Strasbourg goose. You know, that they stuff you with facts and they really stress you out, and there's sleep deprivation. And then there's, you know, the stresses of encountering tough situations, you know, patients dying, patients being angry, sometimes superiors who are abusive. And, you know, you talk a lot about it on your website, that actually you liken the system to kind of a, like an abusive hierarchical system that is punitive and demeaning sometimes to the students.
Right. It's kind of, when I speak to physicians, it's almost like I feel like I'm speaking to a victim of domestic abuse and trying to convince them to leave their abuser.
Yeah.
It's that same, you know, I'm talking about not medical students, more physicians who've had this chronic abuse, and they are in a really toxic, you know, big box clinic, assembly line clinic sort of, mm-hmm. you know, production line schedule, and they are suffering so much, and to try to convince them that they can deserve something better and they don't have to be victimized, it really is like trying to convince an abused woman that Prince Charming could be somewhere out there and that it's safe to leave her, you know, abuser.
Right.
It's a challenging conversation to have because they're in such disbelief and they're so injured chronically from just day one of medical school onward. I mean, it's a culture of bullying, hazing, sleep deprivation, human rights abuse, and mm-hmm. these are all things that we will not stand for in elementary schools or middle schools. With bullying, you know, the student would get in trouble, right? This that there would be no bullying teachers. Mm-hmm. They would, the parents would come to their child's safety, right?
Right.
Hazing is, and that sort of thing. I mean, these universities are closing down fraternities, and they're not standing for this sort of behavior
right.
anymore. But somehow, and sleep deprivation. I mean, you wouldn't get on a plane with a pilot who hasn't slept in 36 hours, or allow a truck driver crossing through the U.S. with, you know, who knows what sort of toxic cargo,
right.
who hasn't slept in 4 days. You know, but we allow and actually condone this sort of behavior in our American hospitals and clinics, much to the detriment of the patients and these poor employed physicians
yeah.
and residents who are treated like slaves. I mean,
yes.
they really are. And when you look at their hourly wage, and they don't follow those work restriction hours, they're supposed to work 80 hours or less. But of course, if you raise your hand and complain that you were 120 hours this week, they'll fire you or get rid of you or pick somebody else. You know, so it's really very scary.
Yeah, you know, I do recall instances in medical school, which for me was a mixed experience. There were elements of, you know, terror and abuse, but there were also, you know, elements of exhilaration and real pride in our accomplishments. But there were professors who were, there's no better way to describe them. They were martinets. They were sort of like, you know, Captain Queeg, or it it was a little bit like the professor in the paper chase, if you remember, that's about law school. And they would almost delight in torturing young doctors with impossible questions and publicly humiliating them when they came up with dumb answers, you know. And part of that regimentation creates doctors who are highly conformist, afraid to deviate from established protocols. And it almost drills into you a kind of mentality that you got to stick to the algorithm and, you know, that's the only way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is something that just perpetuates this antiquated model of medical education that needs to be completely revamped. And I think part of it is that the people who are now leading medical education have been abused themselves. And the problem is they don't see themselves as victims. And when you don't see yourself, you know, let's just take the analogy of the, you know, kind of abusive male, you know, of husband, you know, to his wife. If you don't see yourself as a victim of this domestic violence from your childhood, you somehow see this as a normal way to interact with your wife, right?
Yeah.
You become at high risk of becoming the actual victimizer yourself. So these tormented souls who are now teaching in medical schools, who have been victimized themselves and need serious mental health care and remediation and teaching methods, they don't even see themselves as victims or victimizers. And that's how the cycle just keeps going.
And how about the perfectionistic personality that is engendered in, you know, in pre-med training and medical training? You know, these are kids basically who are on a fast track academically. They're used to getting straight A's. You know, God forbid they should get an A-minus. You know, that's a blemish on their record. And they're passed on, you know, from class to class, teacher to teacher, institution to institution. And they do great. They're the cream of the crop. They get SAT scores and MCAT scores that are through the roof. And then they encounter medical situations where maybe they're not in control, you know, and stuff happens, chaotic, bad stuff happens. And that can be devastating to a kind of tightly wound individual who can't go with the flow, right?
Yeah, absolutely, which is why we need mental health care as a daily, at least weekly, you know, just on the job, you know, something that's accessible to medical students and physicians, because, you know, we're all going to witness our patients die at one point or the other. We're all going to see horrific scenes where we're going to have to tell a woman that her child was born still, you know, was born dead or something. You know, we're going to have to deliver bad news, and we shouldn't just have to stuff that somehow. I don't know where we stuff it, but there's doctors have been stuffing that down for like 20, 30 years. And not, you know, I've met doctors who haven't been able to cry for years just because they've been stuffing the stuff for so long. They've become numb. They need on-the-job counseling, like a grieving room in the hospital, a place where they can safely go and not sit, you know, next to a counselor, next to their transcript, where they feel like if they cry, they might be thrown out for a week. These gifted people need to be treated like gold, and they need to be counseled that it's okay to make a mistake, and it's okay to be human, and it's okay sometimes the patient dies, and it doesn't mean that you're a bad doctor or a bad medical student or you know. And so we need this sort of emotional support, just like police officers and firefighters and anyone in a high risk sort of human trauma, you know, type of field needs access to emotional support. Right.
And the other aspect of it is that, you know, whether or not you care for the psychological well-being of your doctor, it's going to have ramifications for you, because if your doctor is angry, dissatisfied, burnt out, they're going to be abusive to you. And I've seen this kind of attitude. It's very pervasive in hospitals and medical training programs, is that and we've seen instances of this where patients have left recorders on during operations, and the doctors have made abusive comments about the patients, and they treat them like, you know, like it's a big joke, and the patient, you know, they're goofing on the patient's bodily characteristics. And ultimately, you know, when you feel like what's getting between you and a good night's sleep, or a decent weekend or a dinner date is a patient, a sick patient, you're going to hate the patient. It's kind of natural, even as much as you may have good intentions.
Right. And a lot of people use humor to process their pain.
The very,
you know,
dark kind of, very dark humor.
About the patient. You know, and so the thing is, this is all an example of a situation in which physicians have had their human rights impinged upon. They have not had great sleep for years. You know, they cannot function. They're not even doing normal things that people do, like going to bathroom when they have to go have a bowel movement. I mean, they've been holding their bladder for like 12 hours. They haven't eaten. I was in medical school.
That's a familiar strain. Yeah, I recall that.
Yeah, I mean, the medical student standing next to me during a C-section, she was on SlimFast, actually, was trying to lose a little weight, and she ended up on the floor, hypoglycemic, with a blood sugar of 26. Now, me, I was jumping off the wall. I was basically, I made it through med school on no caffeine and just eating carrots and lentil soup. I was asking, I asked them, you know, can you measure my blood sugar? I wonder what it is. And it was 24. Oof. And I was jumping off the wall, just hyper as can be. But the thing is, medical school puts you into a state in which you are really functioning on fumes and working in a hypoglycemic state for hours, if not days, if not weeks. I mean, your body is adjusting to a really inhumane way of living. And so, of course, like, you don't have a lot of compassion left at the end of the day when you haven't been able to take care of yourself for years or go to the bathroom, you know.
It's
an impossible scenario.
Yeah, there's a no-win. You posted an article on your website, by the way, very fine website. It's idealmedicalcare.org, and we're going to get into this concept in a few moments of what is ideal medical care that you strive for. The article's entitled Euphemisms Kill, and what is that about?
That's about our propensity to maintain secrets instead of tell the truth. And it's not just the medical institutions, which should be held to a higher standard of truth-telling since we call ourselves scientists, right? But I mean families, religions, the media, they all try to shield people's tender ears from the truth of suicide, is what I was referring to in that particular article. And so when we pretend like the truth isn't happening, then we continue to perpetuate exactly what we don't want because we're not talking about it. And these are exactly the terms that I've heard used when talking about physician suicide, and I'll just read a few of them.
Sure.
Doctor passed away unexpectedly in his sleep.
Hmm.
Doctor found dead in hospital, declared non-suspicious. How could that be non-suspicious? You've got a 20-some-year-old doctor dead in a hospital in the call room as an anesthesiologist. Doctor
with access to all kinds of powerful drugs. Of course.
Right. Doctor's death and inconvenience for patients. This is a suicide article in the news, and that's how they framed it, as an inconvenience for patients. His light went out too soon. Medical student passed into eternity. How about this one? A doctor found dead on the interstate. No foul play. You know, it's like, okay,
wow.
doctors died by accidental overdose, which is like impossible. We dose drugs for a living.
Yeah.
He went to be with the Lord. I don't know. There's all these things which I can understand them saying this in a church. He went to be with the Lord.
Yeah.
That's fine. Okay. This is a hospital that's sending out a notice. This is, you know, a medical school. You know, we need to be telling the truth, and the truth is going to ultimately save us and help us with data collection. And what's interesting when we decide to tell the truth is that most of these physicians leave notes when they die, and the truth of why they died is clearly explained in their suicide notes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not a mystery. It's just that for some reason, we just keep saying he went to be with the Lord instead of reading the suicide note. It's very fascinating if you were to Google medical student suicide India. In India, they actually read the medical student suicide note on the TV news and actually sometimes even arrest the people that were tormenting the medical student.
Mm.
And that just happens right on the evening news. Here, it's not on the news. If it does make it into the news, sometimes the angle is what an inconvenience for patients.
I have an idea that it may be associated with the myth of physician invincibility, is that to acknowledge that a physician has such deep personal problems, you know, the very person who's holding your life in his or her hands, to acknowledge that they may have been extremely troubled during the time that they were making critical medical decisions about you, is it's hard to swallow. And perhaps that's why they kind of downplay it. So, you know, they just kind of dropped off the end of the earth. And, you know, we're not going to talk more about it, how tragic. But, you know, let's just find another physician, go into the directory and get yourself another doctor.
Yeah, it is kind of destabilizing for patients to realize this, but in a way it creates kind of some more empathy rather than that adversarial relationship mm-hmm. that exists right now between patients and physicians. Once physicians can be seen as human beings, we're just like you. we bleed, we cry, you know, we get depressed. It actually, some patients feel comforted
to
know that their doctors are human. Yeah, and it's definitely liberating for the doctor, but I can understand, you know, physician suicide is kind of like a triple taboo in America, you know, as opposed to India, where I think people in general are more comfortable with the idea of death and the whole natural life cycle, right? Here, it's like death is not a real popular topic. Suicide is certainly not a big popular dinner discussion, and physician suicide, that's like triple taboo. The person we're supposed to be going to for help is injuring himself or herself and has killed. You know, that's it's very destabilizing, I think, for people. But
okay,
telling the truth will help us.
We've scoped out the problem in part one. Our listeners know we divide these podcasts into two parts. You know, there's a tyranny of medical education. There's inhumane conditions under which physicians are trained, and there's sort of institutionalized abuse. And the result is we're losing a big crop of doctors, and with negative ramifications for many patients on the receiving end of their care. In part two, we're going to talk about ideal medical care. Actually, that's the name of the website maintained by today's guest, Dr. Pamela Weibel. So looking towards our goal of ideal medical care in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Please join us.